Election 2012 is wending its way toward its epic finale in November. Doesn't matter which way you vote, the stakes are probably high. So this hour, we blow off a little steam and find the funny in this year's presidential elections. Joining us is our guest, Baratunde Thurston. He's a politically active, technology-loving comedian and the co-founder of the political blog Jack and Jill Politics. He also served as director of digital for The Onion and launched the comedy technology startup Cultivated Wit. Thurston is also the author of How to Be Black. And we want to hear about your favorite campaign gaffes this election season. What hit your funny bone and why? You can call us up at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Baratunde Thurston, welcome.
30s, a frosty night ahead.
And we have the guest, but we are looking for the guest. Baratunde, are you there?
Yes.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kind of a funny start. You couldn't hear it, but we got a little bit of weather instead of you. But I'm glad that you're with us now. Well, tell us, Baratunde, was this a funny election season or just a tense, unpleasant one?
I don't think those are mutually exclusive. Tension and awkwardness often are the heart of comedy. As is pain and discomfort. So we have had a fair share of all those things, including humor, often not intended.
Well, we have a clip that I want to start with. I think gives us a nice taste of some of what's been put out there in terms of the funny in Election 2012. This is from Saturday Night Live.
It seems that more than 96% of voters have already made up their minds about this election. Well, I guess some of us are just a little bit harder to please. We're not impressed by political spin or 30-second sound bites. Before you get our vote, you're going to have to answer some questions. Questions like...
When is the election? How soon do we have to decide?
What are the names of the two people running? And be specific.
Who is the president right now? Is he or she running? Because if so, experience is maybe something we should consider.
How long is a president's term of office? 1 year? 2 years? 3 years? Or life?
If it's for life, frankly, we're not comfortable with that. We don't need to be electing a dictator.
What happens if the president dies? Has anyone thought about who would replace him? What's your plan, gentlemen?
Can women vote? Because if not, as a woman, I've got a big problem with that. And by the way, if men can't vote, in my opinion, that's just as wrong.
Can a woman have a baby just from French kissing?
We are America's undecided voters. There's still a lot we don't know.
And we want answers.
Awesome.
I love that clip. Obviously poking fun at the undecided voter and people who just are clueless about the election. What do you think when you hear that one?
That makes me warm and happy and just fuzzy inside, because there is something to be said for, you know, we have so much access to information in the society. It's relatively free in terms of the actual cash you have to pay to be informed. And at this point, you know, we've had so many campaign ads and the primaries and the debates, and it's like, just make up your mind already. I get that. And whether you're a supporter, you know, I'm a very strong supporter of the president, but if you're a very strong supporter of Mitt Romney as well, like, it's pretty obvious. And it's just fun, you know, it's clear to most people how obvious it is, regardless of their position. So if you're undecided, it's like, what exactly do you need? Do you need a personal visit? Do you need a beer with one of these guys? Do you need a massage? You need to check out, like, all their family records? What's going to actually tip the scale? And do we really want to know what it's going to take in the game to sway somebody? It might disappoint us all.
And we hope it's not what we just heard in that SNL skit.
You know, electing a dictator is probably my favorite line.
I like that part.
Yeah,
that didn't get the biggest laugh, though. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I think maybe there was some uninformed or undecided people in the audience.
One thing that I think about is during the election season is when I usually tune into Saturday Night Live, because that's often when they shine. Thinking back to the last time around, the coverage of Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin was hilarious.
Yeah.
How do you think Saturday Night Live did this election season?
You know, I only see a few clips of shows that get spread around through the social media, so I haven't watched every comedic outlet. I'm also busy trying to produce my own comedy during the season, so I want to be careful not to watch too many things and get influenced and then accused of building upon other people's ideas. So I, based on that clip and based on what I've heard from people, it's been great, but I haven't been as closely monitoring it to be able to say, oh yeah, the Saturday Night Live's been killing it over and over again. I assume so, but I don't know that to be the case. I mean, I think the people that have done the best job of providing humor during this election was really the Republican Party during the primaries. And that whole, it was like one long reality show where each character was a more extreme version of what you've already seen on The Real World or Jersey Shore or something like that. You've got, you know, the guy with the straw hat screaming 999 talking about pizza. You have the woman from the Midwest with the crazy eyes who just shouts the word Constitution but doesn't really know what it means. You've got the guy who's never, ever going to win, but we pull for him anyway, Ron Paul. And I would love a reunion for that cast, you know, a few years from now to see, like, where are they now and what are they up to? Because that was incredibly entertaining. It was frightening, but mostly it was entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch the delegates at the conventions, it's always just interesting to see that slice of America, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, you know, crazy hat people and folks who come from a long way around the country. I mean,
where do they get the hats?
There is a special factory, probably in China, that manufactures hats for people who want to participate in politics to an extreme degree.
Well, you know, one thing to consider as we look at the funny in this election season is just how funny are Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. I mean, you remember with Al Gore, people said he was so wooden they had to wheel him in on a dolly. I mean, he was sort of a funny vacuum back then. Nowadays, yeah. You know, he's got some hip cachet. But are Mitt Romney and Barack Obama funny?
I'm not sure how funny Romney is. He did great at the Al Smith dinner last week. I think those are he did great at delivering jokes, at least. Those are great moments. For both candidates to roast each other, and I thought both candidates did a really great job. The president's got great comedic timing. I mean, we saw it when he was running the last time, and he had almost stand-up quality-esque talent, which made me quite nervous because I've been doing that for a decade, and I'm just like, you have other things to do. Stop being good at what I do. You already have a job. Like, leave mine alone.
Get off my turf.
So, yeah, so, you know, there in the debates, there were a couple moments that really stood out. You know, the horses and bayonets was just an amazing line when Romney was criticizing the president for cutting the number of ships that our military has, saying we have fewer ships now than in 1916. And the president responds, we also have fewer horses and bayonets. That's just not how we fight war anymore. You don't just count ships and then assess the military based on that.
Yeah, we've got a clip of that one, actually. Let's take a listen as long as we're talking about it.
I think Governor Romney maybe hasn't spent enough time looking at how our military works. You mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed. We have these things called aircraft carriers where planes land on them. We have these ships that go underwater, nuclear submarines.
Ouch.
I mean,
do you think he came up with that on the fly?
Unlikely.
Yeah.
I think he obviously delivered it on the fly and found an opening to do so. Maybe horses and bayonets was improvised. He certainly was prepared to answer the criticism because Romney's been saying this and the Republicans have been saying this out loud. It's very hard for the Republicans to accept that they've been sort of outflanked militarily by a Democratic president. It's, you know, time in and time out, you've got the ability to call a Democratic candidate, quote unquote, weak on defense. They want to do these things. They don't want to fight wars. They're pacifists. They're pansies. They're communists. They're socialists. They're hippies. And they don't support our men and women overseas. And that is absolutely not the case with this president. He has outgunned the right with robots, no less. I mean, we are launching drone warfare to a degree imagined only by Skynet. And it's a Democratic president that's done it. So it doesn't leave the right a lot of room. You know, he surged in Afghanistan. He wound down Iraq. These were promises kept from the campaign. And he's done well by veterans, far better than the previous president. So where do you go when you've got no room left to criticize? You start counting votes. And so the Republican Party's been counting votes and trying to drive this home and saying, well, we'll overspend on the military. Like, we'll give them more money than even they want. And the Pentagon's not shy about asking for things, as we know from years of $9,000 toilet seats or whatever. So I think for the president to respond with, you know, a sort of absurdist take on his own was only fitting in that environment. The other fun thing I like to see, though, is if you go to Google and you just start typing in the word horses, the first suggestion to complete that is "and bayonets." Like, this comment has led to the rewiring of the internet itself. They want you to pair bayonets with those horses you're looking for. And maybe you're looking for, like, horse lessons or something, and so you're going to get this whole bayonets thing. And if you haven't been paying attention, that's going to be a very strange experience for you, all thanks to the Republican Party's attempt to criticize a Democratic president who's been super crazy strong on defense and militarism.
Well, you got to appreciate that it brought the word bayonet back into public consciousness. Most of us don't use bayonet in our daily life, so that's back in rotation. But one area I was thinking about was the vice presidential candidates, because they often provide, to me, like, they're often the comic relief. You know, you get a new person and they get picked apart, often in painful but really funny ways. And I thought that, you know, we've been exposed to Joe Biden before. We know about him.
Oh, yeah.
Paul
Uncle
Ryan
Joe's the best.
Was our next candidate this year. He just, I guess he was too handsome. There wasn't that much to say. He's you know what? We've got a clip that sums Paul Ryan up pretty well.
Great.
And I think this is from Saturday Night Live once again.
And you know, Paul Ryan is alluring in that, you know, nice guy next door kind of way. He has the muscles and the money, and your family loves him. But if you've seen any Lifetime movie, you just know he's gonna kill you.
That's our, well, you know, an actress playing Ariana Huffington talking about Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
And there just wasn't that much to say about Paul Ryan in terms of the funny, I didn't think, because he is a good-looking guy. He's solid, and, you know, he ran a marathon. I guess there was some mileage out of what his marathon time was. But he was, you know, in terms of comic fodder, there wasn't as much there as you might have thought.
Well, it takes time often, and I think there are a couple of things that make him a more difficult target, mostly that we can't find him. Paul Ryan is not nearly as public a vice presidential candidate as Sarah Palin was the last time around, as vice presidential candidates generally are, and as we might have expected this guy to be, given the sort of pomp and circumstance of his, you know, nomination. And that he was supposed to be the substantive guy, the policy wonk, the intellectual heavyweight of the right, and have very serious conversations about the budget and about priorities and about entitlement programs. And we haven't really heard very much from him. He gave the convention speech, which was well delivered, not super substantive in terms of factualness, if you're into facts. Not everybody is into facts. I don't want to be biased in a sort of a pro-fact direction. I just lay bare my own tendencies. So, you know, he gave a big speech there, and he's hit the road a little bit, and he obviously had his debate. I thought Joe Biden had a great, my favorite line from that debate was when Joe Biden says, "Oh, you're Jack Kennedy now," as Paul Ryan found himself oddly embracing, you know, John F. Kennedy as some sort of paragon, which the right really doesn't like to do. I think the person who's the unsung hero in terms of political humor from themselves is actually John Kerry. John Kerry came out of nowhere. You know, we remember him from 2004 as basically like kind of the Mitt Romney of 2004. It's like, oh, this guy, no one really loved him. They just hated Bush. And he couldn't quite convert Bush hate into Kerry love fast enough to win that election. And he was stiff, and he had this money, and had Teresa Heinz Kerry, and it was very much out of touch. Pictures of him on yachts and sailboats and Mr. New England upper crust. And he's come out swinging. He had a hilarious speech during the convention. And then he posted something on Twitter this week, referring back to the Binders Full of Women comedy. He says, looks like Romney left his binders of foreign policy. Looks like Romney didn't have any binders of foreign policy. And it was just like, that was a perfectly crafted joke. Like, who did that? Where were you? you know, back 8 years ago.
Yeah, that's what they said about Al Gore, too.
When we all needed you. When we all needed you. So.
Well, you know, before we leave the VPs, Joe Biden, yeah. you referred to him as Uncle Joe. And that is sort of the critique of him, that he's a little too hammy. He's a little over the top. He's kind of the uncle who maybe kicks back a few many drinks at the party and embarrasses himself. And we've got another clip with the faux Ariana on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Between Ryan and Biden, who do you think is friendlier to the women's movement?
Well, Joe Biden possesses some real feminine qualities.
What do you mean?
Every time he referred to Paul Ryan, he said, my friend this and my friend that. Only a woman would call someone their friend and then bitch about them for 90 minutes.
So a little dig on Joe Biden there. What do you think about that one?
I mean, that one's fine. When someone calls you a friend to your face out loud with the word friend, they generally don't mean it. And that was the sort of stronger take on his use of friend that I thought about that particular debate. I love Joe because Joe, we're on a first name basis. Me and Joe just kicking it all the time. But he actually projects that level of comfort with himself and doesn't mind. You know, he does slip up every once in a while, but it's never like a dramatic policy situation. He doesn't slip up and say like, oh, I don't think women should be in control of their bodies. Oops. Like, it's not that kind of mistake. It's almost like a little too honest for the public to take or for political handlers and consultants to bear with. But he's that guy. He's still the guy from Delaware. And there's something really comforting and comfortable about somebody who's so clearly comfortable with himself. And so he's funny because he's just himself and fully at ease with all that. And that's reassuring in sort of a positive sense for me, as opposed to a level of uncomfortable, you know, with themselves, like John Kerry back in 04. Al Gore didn't feel very comfortable with himself, so the humor around them was, you know, more of like, oh, you're awkward, you're kind of faking it. Joe was like, no, you're being maybe too real for the public at times. But that's a rare problem in politics, so I'll accept that.
Well, our guest this morning is Baratunde Thurston, a politically active, technology-loving comedian from the website Cultivated Wit, and he has also founded the political blog Jack and Jill Politics and served as director of digital for The Onion. His book is called How to Be Black, and we're talking this hour about the funny moments in election 2012, and hopefully hearing some of yours, maybe from this election or maybe from elections past, moments that stick out in your mind as being highlights of funny. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And stick around at 10 o'clock for a Wisconsin Life Halloween special as we listen to the winning entries in the Wisconsin Life Flash Fiction Ghost Story Contest with the judge and fantasy writer Patrick Rothfuss. This hour, we're joined by Baratunde Thurston. He is the author of How to Be Black, and he also served as digital director for The Onion and launched the comedy technology startup Cultivated Wit. And we're talking about finding the funny in election 2012 as we get close to that big November voting day, looking back at those funny moments and taking a look at Saturday Night Live, other funny clips that have come out during that time. So share your favorites at 1-800-642-1234. And we go next to our first caller. Bert is joining us from Rice Lake. Hi there.
Yeah, great show. Thank God there's humor in elections. And I think that person that does it better is Jay Leno. He just does a good job. And the line the other night, President Obama was on for a whole hour, and Jay was asking him a whole bunch of questions, and one of the questions finally came around that Jay asked the president. He says, well, what about this Donald Trump thing? What's going on with that? And President Obama, without missing a stroke, says, well, it all goes back when he and I grew up in Kenya and we played soccer. And I think Jay Leno just fell off the chair. It was so quick and funny.
Hmm. That's a good one. So have you been watching all of the late night guys trying to take stock of who's doing the best job with it?
No, I really haven't. I mean, here's the deal. There's a 1,000 hours of programming of TV on every hour, plus lives to live and tweets to be sent. So I haven't been able to see all of that, but I did see that clip. And your caller is absolutely correct about the president's response there. He, once again, effectively shut down, this insane criticism coming from the biggest charlatan that this country's known for several generations. He did it, when he did the correspondence dinner last time around, and he had this video clip, and he just destroyed Donald Trump to his face. And I think the failure of the joke is really not of the president. Like, he's done a great job of responding to some insanely offensive, lowbrow, and just downright idiotic relentlessness on the part of Trump. It's the fact that the rest of us keep paying attention to Trump and won't let this issue die. So I'm not sure, what there is left to do. I mean, the president can't respond seriously to such insanity. So humor is really the only option he has. And he's done it more gracefully than I think most other people would. In a circumstance, but how does it feel to have, a very prominent public figure who's extremely wealthy and embraced very closely by your opponent and the opposition party say you're not an American over and over and over? You don't qualify to be here. You didn't belong in the college you went to. There's plenty to criticize the president for, but like being a secret Kenyan Muslim who didn't actually get into college, like, come on now, that's insane. So his, deflection of that through humor is wonderful and notable and noteworthy and laudable. I think our general national reaction to Trump is pretty shameful in that he's still accepted in polite company. Like, people still shake his hand and invite him on television and listen when he says things. He should have no credibility left. He should be like in some sort of do not call list for every reporter in the country. And he's not. So I think that's our failure. But the president's sort of risen to the occasion beyond anything I might have expected at this point.
All right. Well, let's go to our next phone call. We've got Anne joining us from Duluth. Hi, Anne.
Hi. My daughter told me yesterday to Google Romney on a bar stool. So I did. And I've been laughing for 24 hours. He apparently had to practice how to sit on a bar stool for the debate. And I was sitting on my bar stool in the kitchen. I guess the insinuation was that he doesn't go to bars. There are many of us who sit on bar stools in different places, but I thought that was just so funny.
All right. Thanks, Anne. I have trouble sitting on a bar stool, but I'm short, so that's my excuse.
I had not heard that one. It sounds plausible. Maybe he's more used to like a chaise lounge or something like that. Romney, when you think about the conventions, I was on the ground for both conventions. I'd never gone to a Republican convention before. And the major theme of that convention was to try to make Mitt Romney look like a human being and really to build a connection between him and the people because he felt so distant. And it wasn't to lay out a plan to, save America. It wasn't to criticize the president only. It was really like, if we could just make this guy look like a person, we will have accomplished our goals. So it seems very credible that he might have had barstool sitting lessons. That should just be like evolutionarily built in. Like, you should just know how to sit at a barstool. But I find it not shocking given what I saw down in Tampa.
Now, I want to keep it a little more nonpartisan as we find the funny in this season. And to talk about Obama, a criticism of Obama has been that this guy is too slick. He's too cool. I mean, he's never going to be the one you think of as being goofy. He did have a couple big gaffes. But is that a criticism of Obama? Is that, that humanity, that being a little bit more loose at the hip, maybe making more mistakes? I don't know, that it's harder to humanize him now than it was the first time around.
I really don't see that with him in terms of a criticism of him that he's too cool. That doesn't resonate with me. What I've heard about him that feels a bit more true is that he is, extra confident, arrogant, is the word that the right would use to describe him. And you might have even seen that in the first debate, where it's like, really? I have to be bothered with this now? I've got like a country to run and a world to kind of calm down. Why am I talking to this guy who doesn't know how to sit at a bar stool? So there might have been some condescension in his tone in that first debate, which is like, I got this. Like, really, I'm going to run against the guy whose healthcare plan I basically copied for the rest of the country, who worked for Bain and all this stuff, and an underestimation of his opposition, which, you know, you see very dramatic shift in his attitude in the subsequent debates and on the stump as well. So the criticism of Obama is too cool. That seems like a lot of that shine has actually worn off a little bit, because once you're the president, you can't be cool. Like, you do things that people hate. It's your right. job to be despised by a significant number of people.
You can't be an outsider anymore. Planet.
Yeah, you're Washington now. So
yeah.
I think, you know, a criticism of him as naive about how much he might be able to get done. Criticism of him as arrogant and overconfident. Criticism of him as kind of overpromising and not delivering on all those. That makes a ton of sense to me. But too cool. Now, he's not great on the dance floor. We saw that on Ellen the last time around. He's got a great jump shot, that's for sure. And so, you know, he has occasional cool moments in that realm. But presidents, there's a cap on how cool you can be when you're the president of the United States.
Well, one thing that did get him into trouble is this next clip.
If you've been successful, you didn't get there on your own. You didn't get there on your own. I'm always struck by people who think, well, it must be because I was just so smart. There are a lot of smart people out there. If you were successful, somebody along the line gave you some help. There was a great teacher somewhere in your life. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we had that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
The you didn't build that running criticism that went on for a while. You know, that was before Mitt Romney's version of it, which was the 47%. I mean, what did you think about that one, Baratunde?
So, you know, I'm glad you played the whole clip. Because the context is so clear to me, at least, I suppose if you are not a fan of the president, you hear a certain thing and are unforgiving about that. Which is, he says, I didn't build my business. Screw that guy. I did this. If you are a supporter of the president, you hear, you know, all success is shared to some degree because it came on the backs of people who came before you, people who taught you, or the society that provided, you know, the infrastructure for you to actually build your business. One is an uncharitable interpretation. One is a very charitable interpretation. Maybe the truth is in the middle. I tend to, you know, in a very biased sense, understand fully what he meant, though the right was like, oh, we're not letting that go. Like, it was too good. It was too juicy a morsel to let it sit there. So regardless of the intention, it was not well phrased to be able to clip that little piece out and say, you didn't build that. If you have a business, you didn't build that. And the Republicans ran with that completely, far beyond my imagination. There was a whole day. Each day at the RNC had a theme. And one full day was devoted to, we built that. And they had T-shirts and hashtags. They paid for a hashtag, I believe, on that day on Twitter. You know somebody's really serious when they do a hashtag campaign about it. And it was all over the LCD screens in the Tampa Convention Center. Because it tapped into, you know, this notion, it tapped into this narrative that, like, he's going to come into our homes and take our money and give it away to poor people. Money that we earned from businesses that we built. And no one wants that to happen. You know, the government is coming and garnishing your wages in that direct sort of violent sense, even though that's actually what government does through progressive taxation, et cetera. So it was a great moment for the right to be able to exploit that, though, you know, I see it as a bit of an intentional misinterpretation. I obviously see why they did it, and they got a lot of mileage out of it.
In terms of following Twitter, I mean, you're an avid tweeter. Are there some that stand out to you as being just exceptionally funny this season?
Well, you know, the John Kerry one during the last debate was great. I love following the tweets of Liz Winstead. She's a co-creator of The Daily Show and has a great book out called Liz Free or Die, LIZZ. And she is a can't-miss Twitter account that's a ton of fun to follow along with. So what I really like about Twitter, though, is that you, especially around these collective moments, when there is a slip or a moment, people pounce right away. I mean, you saw it during the convention with Clint Eastwood talking to the chair, speaking of bar stools, and someone created an invisible Obama, you know, fake account. You saw it with the binders full of women comment and the instant reaction to that. So you've got, you know, the campaigns and the candidates themselves using humor. You've got established, real trained comedic voices. But then you have this, the general public finding some joy in the absurdity of all these moments and running with it. And when you have thousands and thousands of people doing that, you often end up in some pretty brilliant spaces.
And what are you doing during the debates? Are you tweeting during the debates?
Oh, yeah. I have a whole command center set up. I am following, you know, I'm watching the debate generally online, though this week I was overseas in London, which was strange to be there. Just this is a foreign policy debate in which Europe didn't come up at all. And I'm sitting in Europe and feeling a bit left out of my own country's conversation. There was a lot of Israel talk, some Syria, China, obviously, lots of fear-mongering around China on both sides. But no Africa, no Europe. That's like a big chunk of the world right there, especially with the crisis going on with Greece and the financial system. I might have expected some comments. So my role in Twitter is, you know, I watch and I do kind of live Mystery Science Theater 3000 style commentary, doing a little bit of fact-checking, and I'm retweeting things from folks that I think are saying some good stuff. So I have a list of comedians on Twitter that I've built up and occasionally check into that and fire off something that's a lot of fun. I mean, The Onion's been doing a great job with the debates. They have
what have you seen from The Onion?
Character. Well, they have Joe Biden live tweeting the debates, you know, in his satirical Onion version of himself voice. And so that's really kind of cool and very creative way to have a unique take on the process. There's another account that I love following. It's Thing X, and they did real-time fact-checking during all the debates, and they were fact-checking the fact-checkers instead of going to this absurd degree. We've had a very high season for fact-checking as like a profession. I don't know if I've heard the term fact-check so much outside of this, you know, last 3 months than in the rest of my entire life combined before those moments. And so that's rife for parody as well.
Well, speaking of Joe Biden and The Onion, we do have an email from Bill who says, I think The Onion's ongoing series on Joe Biden, cooling it in Mexico, hitchhiking to the convention, jumping a motorcycle over the Vietnam Memorial, etc., is the best. It's really redefined Joe as a lovable buffoon.
Yeah, and I mean, that's going back to the Uncle Joe character. I mean, I was there when, you know, that version of Joe Biden was born. It was during, we did a special package of the first 100 days of the Obama administration. And there was one kind of update for each day. So it was essentially 100 one-liner jokes. And that was the first time that that Biden was born as this sort of womanizing, smooth-talking, everyday, almost Fonzie-esque character who, you know, keeps a little capsule of Banaka in his pocket, has copies of, adult magazine We in his briefcase that he's take sneaking glimpses of during National Security Council briefings, installs an arcade in the Naval Observatory in D.C. Just to pass the time. And then you see the Dave and Buster's version of him. And, when he has a summit for the ladies and, you know, his 10-point plan for them. It's really fun because it went beyond the politics element of him. And really, it was a deep dive into the personality or what we kind of all wish the personality of Joe Biden was, and he really isn't that dude, but he's believably that dude to the degree that it'd kind of be cool to have a guy like that. Like, it might be terrible, but actually it'd be pretty cool. It'd be definitely hilarious if he really were like that. And he likes it himself. He commented on a Yahoo video some years ago when they asked him, have you been paying attention to The Onion's version of you? And he said he absolutely loved it, which was a really high mark. For any comedian, it was a pretty flattering response.
Well, thanks for that email, Bill. And we are talking this hour with Varatunde Thurston. He is a politically active, technology-loving comedian and co-founder of the political blog Jack and Jill Politics. And he's the author of the book How to Be Black. And we're talking this hour about finding the funny in election 2012. But we can also look at seasons past, moments that have stuck out in your mind as being high marks of comedy during election seasons, which are typically these very tense, unpleasant times. But there is also, in these moments, moments of comic brilliance. What sticks out for you? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Think monsters are make-believe? Join Ira Flato for a look at the history of real, live zombies and why vampires hate garlic. You can hear more on Science Friday today at 1 o'clock. We're talking this hour with Baratunde Thurston, our guest, who is a comedian and the founder of the startup Cultivated Wit and the political blog Jack and Jill Politics. And we're talking about funny moments from elections past and present. And we'll take our next caller now. We've got Michael joining us from Janesville. Hi there.
Hi. I wanted to call about a video I watched yesterday. There's a YouTube sketches called Epic Rap Battles in History, and there's one on Romney versus Obama, and it's kind of vulgar, but they both put each other down, and my favorite part of the video was at the end, Abe Lincoln comes, and he just basically slams both the candidates and says they're being kind of childish and how they need to grow up, and I just really thought it was really funny at the end to have Abe Lincoln come in.
I like that. I'm going to have to look that up, Michael. Have you seen that one, Baratunde?
No, I haven't. There's a, you know, there was a time, a long, long time ago, like 1996, where you could see everything on the internet that was worth seeing, and we have long since escaped that time. That people are constantly emailing me something or tweeting something, saying, "Oh, have you seen this? Have you seen that?" And the answer is almost always no at this point, because there's so much stuff that's worth seeing, and there's so much creativity and so much cool stuff going on. That's one example, you know, what the caller just talked about, and it's like I hadn't even heard of it until just now. I'm gonna, you know, check that out when we're done. I can get back
what
on.
What it reminds me
on
of
proper internet
is, you know, one of the critiques that people, well, the commentary about the second election or the second debate rather. That these were two guys who seemed to have a lot of animosity for each other. And a friend of mine actually commented on Facebook, you know, at the third debate they were sitting down, and he said, "I liked it better when they were walking around because there was a chance that one of them was going to take a punch at the other one." And, you know, the commentators were all saying after the second debate, like, "Wow, this is going to break the mold of history. I've never seen a debate with this much rancor in it." And I wonder what you think. Is there any truth to that?
I don't, probably not. Just because, and I'm basing that on the fact that, you know, commenters of elections on TV, maybe not the most credible spokespeople for what is an extreme stance, like for the most ever. That's almost like a sales pitch. It's the most partisan ever. It's the most violent time ever. It's the most animosity ever. I mean, when you have hearings on un-American activities and, you know, people in Hollywood are being outed and blacklisted and lives ruined. Like, that was a pretty rancorous time in American history. And we had TVs, and that was going on in the public face. There is some truth to, you know, the level of divisiveness, given that we all have our own media bubbles that we can retreat into, right and left. And we can kind of surround ourselves with bubbles of information that don't necessarily let other perspectives in. So I think that part is true, but anytime someone says the most, the best, the
blank
worst,
ever, like, yeah,
words that end in ST, generally they are being the least honest in that commentary. So I didn't see, there was definitely some tension in the debate and they're walking around. It was also just an awkward setup.
It was awkward.
You're like, when do you stand up? When do you sit down? What's up with these stools?
And how much can Candy Crowley do? Did she do
yeah,
too
she
much? Did
like,
she not do enough?
Them down.
Yeah.
Like, she's not going to go. There's no actual like bouncers to separate them. And there was a tone set as well because of the first debate where, you know, Romney was hyper aggressive and had nothing to lose. And so he put it all on the table. And the president was hyper relaxed and kind of like, I don't necessarily want to be here right now in terms of his tone. He knew he couldn't do that again. So he came back ready to go. And Romney, this is a different setting because you're like in physical proximity. You can't hide behind the podium. All the prepared remarks don't work as well because you're taking questions from the public. So you don't have as much likelihood of guessing what they're going to be asking you about. And the moderator, you know, was much more forceful in the second one. Jim Lehrer really let Romney kind of be hyper aggressive and roll over the time and dominate a bit more. And so did the president to some degree. In the second one, Candy wasn't having that. And she's like, no, you're done now. We're going to move on to the next one. We have other voters' questions to get to. So that there was more room for physical tension and frustration because I think they were both amped up, but had to be contained still within the format.
Right. All right.
It would be cool if there was a like a UFC fight between the candidates. You know, at some point, you do kind of wish for people to actually put skin in the game and not like all the way. You don't need to break bones and things like that, but you could add some Jello or
thumb
some
wrestling.
Mud. Yeah. Like it'd be a good fundraiser. You know, I think both sides of the political divide and people who are on either side could probably support it. You have a great pay-per-view type situation going on. You could stream it on YouTube, like with Felix Baumgartner jumping out the thing. You could get some great sponsorships going from both sides. It'd be a great way to bring the country together before ripping it asunder.
It's not a bad idea. You'll have to get that out there for next time.
Just throwing it out there. You know, I'm all about solutions, you know.
Clearly. All right, let's go to Paula in Mauston. Hi, Paula.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I think that the sort of political humor that I found most pertinent and sort of in a way disturbing this election came in the movie Madagascar 3. There's a lot of, like, European stereotypes being played out and American ones, too. So the big ones are French socialism and American capitalism, and the line is the French only work 2 weeks a year. And what I see in this election is that, in particular, both parties seem to blither wrongly about what European socialism might look like, but the Republican Party particularly uses it as a scare tactic. And I don't think anybody who's even a Democrat would necessarily feel comfortable in a really top-down society. I mean, the United States is a bottom-up society, and so I think Republicans using it as a scare tactic is just showing themselves to not have any information, if somebody believes that. There isn't the possibility of America working 2 weeks a year, you know? So that's why everybody in the room laughed, but I said, yeah, you know, but it represents something that people actually talk about as a real possibility.
What do you think, Bartende?
Yeah, you know, one of the I like what your caller had to say about our sort of misinformation, misinterpretation about just what European socialism is and using it to scare people. We, as the people, you know, we focus a lot on the candidates and their faults and their extremism and their hilarity intended and otherwise, and to some degree on the media and the show around this. But some of the biggest contributions to the absurdity theater that is the election are the American people themselves. Like, we can be terrible, just terrible people. And we're so used to hearing candidates pander to us and tell us how great we are, how smart we are, how hardworking we are, how we're just the best people in the world. No one's better than Americans. Maybe. Depends on the day of the week, right? Depends on what we're watching on television right now. Like, when we're watching Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, we're not the best people in the world at that particular moment, right? We could be a lot better. And when we, you know, fear things we don't understand, we're not the best people in the world either. Especially, you know, for people that generally don't leave their country, it's kind of, you know, an interesting position to take to kind of judge a whole part of the world you've never actually seen, and one which inspired a big chunk of how your own society is organized. I mean, socialism's a big, scary word, and we like to run around and run away from big, scary words. America's a socialist society, too, when you take that very broad definition of it. We redistribute wealth. We help people who need assistance. We prioritize based on our budget funding, et cetera. We have a healthcare system and are going into the direction of an even more providing one and a more equal footing one. And we subsidize big business. We subsidize military. We subsidize the airlines. Like, there's no such thing as like a purely capitalist America that anyone would actually want to live in. That's one with no regulation. That's one where your kids are like chewing raw nuclear material from toys made by, you know, some sort of evil gang that's just doing a great job making money. and a terrible job at actually having a civil society.
Well, I want to jump in and get to another caller if we can.
Yeah, well, we paint European socialism as like, oh, it's a big scary thing. It's like, well, okay, if you don't want any kind of regulations or you want like just death flowing out of your faucet, sure, go for that. Otherwise, we're pretty socialist too, and it's not the worst thing in the world.
Well, Paul, I appreciate that call. And we go next to Karen, who's in Cottage Grove. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hello, Veronica and Mr. Thurston.
Hello.
First of all, I wanted to just put in a quick plug for Epic Battles of History. My son showed me a lot of them. There are probably 10 or 15, and they're hilarious and very quick-witted. You can watch one of them like three or four times and still not catch all that's going on. But anyway, the reason I had called is that we had watched Barack Obama on Jay Leno a couple of nights ago and were absolutely amazed at his quick-wittedness. There were probably five or six instances in which Jay asked the president a question, and his wit was so amazing that we were wondering if they possibly didn't plan a couple of the little conversations ahead of time. So I don't know if you have any perspective on that. Just wondering.
Yeah,
great question.
You know, I wasn't able to. I normally have a weekly conference call with the president, but I've been very busy lately, so I'm not sure how they handled this particular interview. I wouldn't be surprised in either direction. I mean, the president talks for a living. He interacts with thousands upon thousands of people. He has to be prepared for almost every eventuality, literally, like war, floods, famine, stock market crashes, you know, blunders by his campaign staff, blunders by himself, his opposition, like political policy, military. So once you've been doing that day in and day out for years and you've built a big chunk of your life to get in there, it wouldn't surprise me if you are also rhetorically prepared for a lot of things coming at you that are unexpected and to be able to respond and deflect in that case.
I'm sure he's quick on his feet, but don't you think that people who go on these late night talk shows prepare vignettes ahead of time with the producers and probably work up a little bit of material, a little bit of shtick, and then the comedian introduces it and then they kind of run with it, with what they prepared? That's what I always assume, never having been on any of these TV shows. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's also possible. That's what I was going to get to as well. Like, I think it's either way is believable. I don't particularly think it matters in the end. I think, you know, if it's rehearsed and known and it comes across that way, that's a problem because it's like, oh, you can't even do the thing you practiced.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what we demand and want is a feeling of authenticity, and doing that all day, every day is also very taxing. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's some preparation, but I also think, given what the job of presidency is and given what we saw from this candidate even before it became president when that wasn't really possible, he's probably doing a lot of it on his own as well. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much, Karen. And another caller, Paul, joins us from Racine. Hey, Paul.
Hi. Veronica, always, always top-notch shows that you have. So thank you.
Thank you.
Great guests and the great topics. And I don't want to come across as a fuddy-duddy with my question, which I'll preface by saying that, you know, it seems that modern comedy it has kind of evolved along with modern politics and modern media. And so we're seeing, you know, this genesis of just some of the greatest comedy out there. And fortunately, so many of our comedians, like your guest, are the ones that are saying some of the most insightful things. They may not think that, but they are. I mean, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert as examples wouldn't be as popular as they are, not for just making us laugh, but for making us think. But does your guest, is there any concern in the, you know, the comedians and the comic community that such insightful comedy, while making us laugh, might also distract us from thinking about some of these very serious issues that we're grappling with as a society and that we're seeing discussed in these debates? And
right. And Paul, I'm going to cut you off just there so we can have Bartunde answer. We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, great question, Paul. And I think that my briefest possible answer is no to very little. You know, the first order of comedy is to be funny. And many comedians within that realm are also trying to deliver a point of view and a perspective and at least a version of truth as they see it. It's not to be the end-all, be-all solution for all of society's problems. It can often make way for those solutions to be more visible when you can affect someone's mindset. So I think all these things happen in parallel, and I think it's maybe a bit too much pressure on the comedian to think that their work is a distraction from real problem solving. I think the opposite's more likely true, that for folks on the margin, a great joke may loosen them up a bit, may get them to a different space where they can hear a thought that they would never hear from someone directly opposed to them, and that you can help shift the conversation or the mood of the conversation enough to allow for solutions to better present themselves. That's
all right.
At least
I'm sorry, we're
I
out of time. Bartende Thurston, thank you very much for joining us. Bartende Thurston, politically active, technology-loving comedian we were talking to today, the author of How to Be Black. And thanks to Marika Suval and Rhonda Fanning for production this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.